This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Thank you very much for being here this morning. I love San Diego. I think San Diego is one of the most interesting, dynamic places, struggling, getting so many of the decisions right, and you've got such great resources here. I've had the pleasure, when I used to live in Southern California, before I moved to the cesspool of Washington, D.C., this is a place I came down to frequently, and we've been, our partnership with Mary Walshock has been one of the really bright spots of my career at The Atlantic. So let me just say a few words about this topic and our great panelists here. I'm going to start with Mary Walshock. Of course, Mary Walshock is the Associate Vice Chancellor for Public Programs, the Dean of Extension at UC San Diego. She's a sociologist. She's just taken a tour of many of the, I should call them spots in the country that are having a rough time, Flint, Michigan, Rochester, New York, and did something that a lot of MSNBC contributors should have done, is talk to real people out there and what's happening. She's a thought leader, particularly on a topic that I think is very important this morning, on aligning workforce development with regional economic growth. And she's the author of Innovation and Reinvention, The Evolution of San Diego's Entrepreneurial Economy. You can get it on Amazon and have it delivered before the holidays.
Yes.
So for those of you who want just a real zinger of a book. So, and Richard Florida is, I must cross editorial lines, is one of my great friends, but he's also just an extraordinary force. MIT, in a study they did, identified him as the only thought leader in the world who mattered. He was essentially, another way to say it, the most important thought leader in the world, changing the way we thought about ourselves, our identities, what mattered and what doesn't. And oftentimes, when you see a topic like we have today, which is the formal title of San Diego's Urban Core, the Innovation Economy's Next Frontier. This all sounds like rah-rah, really good,
yeah,
let's just kind of go. But to understand the choices, the equation of getting something right, you have to know the bad as well as the good. You have to look at what cities and communities may aspirationally hope for, but it takes an understanding of what doesn't go well. And this is what Richard Florida brought. If you read The Rise of the Creative Class, and I assume that you've signed a copy over to Donald Trump, and it will be on his shelf in the Oval Office, right, Richard? Have you sent Donald a copy of your book?
I forgot to.
I'll do it this afternoon. But Rise of the Creative Class. But Richard has a new book coming out entitled The New Urban Crisis, How Our Cities Are Increasing Inequality, Deepening Segregation, and Failing the Middle Class, and What We Can Do About It. And I want to say the reason that it's important to mention both of these is that Richard, despite many things, he's of course, one of the world's leading urbanists. He is a researcher and professor serving as the director of the Martin Prosperity Institute at the University of Toronto's Rotman School of Management. He founded the Creative Class Group. But the most important thing he did is a partnership that I feel very much part of, and that was at The Atlantic, in creating a channel for us called City Lab. He founded City Lab. He continues to be editor at large, and he's a senior editor for The Atlantic. But for those of you who are not, how many of you are urban policy junkies? Just be brave. Raise your hand.
Of course, you all are.
Good, yeah. So Richard Florida is a big deal in this world, and City Lab has turned out to be the most read channel on these issues that we've talked about, and Richard has taken us there. And we created, because we weren't just comfortable with just a website, we created a conference. The movie is coming soon called City Lab. But we have an annual City Lab conference. We work with the Aspen Institute and Mike Bloomberg and Bloomberg Philanthropies on looking at best and promising practices in how urban environments can get smarter, better, cooler, hipper, and whatnot. And Richard's insight was, let's bring a lot of, I won't ask how many of you urban junkies are boring bureaucrats running cities, and I have great respect for you. But half of our audience are those type of people, and the other half are creatives. And I can't tell you, when you sit and you see, you know, COOs and people that are head of procurement, folks that come in these cities, and they're mixing with folks that design the High Line in New York, or we're working on the sort of Los Angeles River and how to bring the community into contact with that. This is Richard Florida's genius. And so I do want to just tip my hat to that extraordinary capability of understanding where. So let me just open this. We're going to have a conversation. You guys can finish each other's sentences or protest what we. But we've just had a major moment, a major choice in American society, and it's very, very clear that we have two worlds within cities, within the country. And Richard, I'm interested, within the prism of helping those of us in San Diego today understand how to get to a healthy, inclusive, innovative environment, what are the lessons that we should take from what just happened last Tuesday?
Well, thank you, Steve, for those kind words, and thank you, Mary, for bringing us all together. I'll have a piece up on the site probably during this conversation, so feel free to look at it on the state level.
On the Atlantic site.
On the Atlantic site.
Atlantic.com, City Lab.
On the state demographics, and we're working because actually the county level data is still being cleaned. It's not all in. We'll have a post next week on the metropolitan level dynamics. But our colleague Ron Brownstein, I mentioned to you,
right.
Southern Californian, by the way, who is the most brilliant political analyst in the world, has a post up this morning. And basically, look, the lines of our division are pretty clear. And I'll come back to San Diego just in a moment. We are not just a blue and a red country. The lines of our division are along class and location, and class and geography. Another way of saying that, knowledge and education, and urban versus suburban and rural. I have all the correlations here. I actually took them out. I'm not going to bore you with them, but it is striking and daunting that first thing I want to say is this isn't new. The statistical correlations between Hillary Clinton's vote, Barack Obama's vote in 2012 and 2008 are 0.95. Mm-hmm. That means despite the different outcomes. And the correlations between Mr. Trump's vote, Mr. Romney's vote, and Mr. McCain's vote are about 0.95, meaning these divides are persistent. I went back and looked at a post I wrote for us in 2011 in which I said the United States, in terms of its large geography, was becoming redder. There were peaks and spikes of blueness, but they were being overwhelmed because the creative class, the knowledge class, everything I wrote about was packing itself into these clustered areas. And I said that this would continue and that what my worry was not the social and cultural fallout. Of course, I have my own political persuasion, but I was worried that this increased reddening, if you will, could dampen down the very sources of innovation by not providing the funding in terms of universities, knowledge bases, infrastructure they needed to survive. So I looked back on that and I said, boy, I had it more on the money than I thought at the time. I think that's our divide, which brings me to this, my own work. If you think about it, there are three great classes in America. My own creative class. I have your statistics here. I want to get them right. 33% of the American workforce, about 40 or 50 million of us. In San Diego, that's about 400,000 of you, 32% of the workforce. The blue-collar working class, which has been declining over the long sweep of history, it was as high as 50% of the workforce. It's now 20%. You know, only 5% of Americans work in factories, by the way, when people talk about bringing back manufacturing. Mm-hmm. In the United States, nearly 70 million people work in the low-wage, contingent, precarious service class. Actually, when people talk about the new voting bloc, that's the one they should be talking about. That's the one that does swing. In San Diego, by the way, that's 50% of your workforce. So I built a new urban crisis index. I'll give you a little preview. I promised Mary, Chris, I'd come back and talk about the book when it's launched in April.
But you can buy it now.
San Diego ranks, as Mary knows and you all know, as one of the most innovative, creative, knowledge-based clusters in the world. It ranks highly on my own creativity index. I came here in 2003 and talked about that. It ranks highly on my metrics of technology, talent, and tolerance. It's one of the startup and innovative centers of the world with attracting over $1 billion in venture capital funding. It ranks 10th on my new urban crisis index, which is a metric of inequality, economic class-based segregation and housing unaffordability, and 5th among metros over 1 million people. Mm-hmm. Our great centers of innovation, the very clustering force that drives innovation, that causes us to cluster and concentrate, also divides us. It prices us out. And that's why this area of inclusive economic development is so important. Our great success story over the past decade and a half, and I think Mary and I would agree, is that we've made economic development a priority of urban and metropolitan centers, and we've done it successfully. I think it's been our great success. But we have not focused enough, and I blame myself, on making that economic development inclusive. That's the task of the next decade, and I think it's so appropriate that we're here today to kick this off.
you know, just before we jump to Mary, it's interesting. We had a piece in The Atlantic recently written by Jane Jacobs, the great profiler and chronicler of cities, the rise and the life and death and contours of cities. She, in one of her books, told the story of Higgins, North Carolina, and saw these divides. She also, like you, worried about the fragility of communities, the fragility of democracy. She wrote a book called The Dark Age Ahead that I imagine pretty much tracks a little bit with your concerns in the new urban crisis to some degree. But really, I'm interested in not, you know, focusing on the negative as much as I am, and how do you begin to think about getting the equation right? So what does a community, given the data, how do you begin to sort of say, you know, we can make a better picture out of this, we can turn a divided world into a united world, we can begin using those currents of passion in different ways. So I'm interested in what insights you have.
So it's very interesting how closely we think alike. Out of the darkness always comes the dawn. Jane and I were dear friends. We became friends when I moved to Toronto, and I just gave a talk literally earlier this week. I'm writing a piece. This is so interesting how much this election has caused me to introspect. I'm writing a piece about Jane now. Mm. 10 years before I got the idea, I always said Jane was at least 10 to 20 years ahead of me. 10 years before I got the idea of the new urban crisis, Jane published her book, actually, yes, almost a decade ago.
2004.
12 years. She published Dark Age Ahead. And I got to know Jane, and we had a conversation, unfortunately not videotaped, but there are detailed notes about that conversation. I went back and I reread them after she published that book. Jane Jacobs is the greatest urbanist of all time, the person who told us the value of the neighborhoods and communities we lived in. I have come to conclude was really a pessimist. The three last books, Steve, the four last books, the two that were published were called Systems of Survival, Dark Age Ahead. The fourth book that was never published, the two books that could be brought out in essays after her death, one was going to be on the rise of the plantation economy and how it had left it, and the other one was called A Short but Sad Biography of the Human Race. Jane, think about it.
She was
born in Scranton, Pennsylvania, in a mining town that collapsed. A child of the Depression who moved to New York City in 1934. A person who worked in your world. Her initial jobs were in security studies, tracking the rise and fall of Hitler and Stalin and fascism and totalitarianism. A person who was herself a target of the McCarthy era.
Mm-hmm.
What did she see in this darkness? Why did she write Death and Life of Great American Cities? Because for her, our cities and communities were the source of light. They were the source of the dawn. No one understands this. They see her as talking about short blocks and mixed use. For her, the cities were the source of civilization, the source of economic progress, the source of tolerance, the source of diversity, the source of democracy, everything that was good in the world, even though she was so frightened by everything else. That's the point. And you and I were talking this morning. I actually believe that this blue and red America can't survive anymore in the way we are. You and I have been talking about this. Jim Fallows, Mary, you know this. I actually think we need a mutual coexistence strategy. We need a detente. We need to respect each other. I can't make everyone live in my world. You can't make me live in your world. I think the time is right to have a serious conversation about devolving more power out of Washington and bringing real power to our states and localities, giving them the money and the tools they need to build and letting us, and making, I hate to say it, the federal government less relevant so people on one side or the other aren't in tears on election day anymore and we can focus on what works. I think the great opportunity now, and that's why I just want to say, Mary, thank you for that, is to bring together left and right to being a big tent of people who care about their communities and focus on how do we create an inclusive development strategy for all
of us. I welcome that, and people like me are totally, at least I am ready to move to San Diego immediately. Mary, you know this community in town, and when you look at sort of the migration that you've seen here, the clusters of talent that are building, your role in the university and reaching out to different parts of the community, kind of give us a snapshot of what is the best you see and the most troubling you see.
So let me start with three things, picking up on Rich's point about a big tent. And everybody in the room knows I wrote a book about San Diego's innovation history. It's a story about a big tent. This is a town where Republicans and Democrats do sit down, at least in terms of the political spectrum, in part because we don't have lots of big companies and lots of super rich people. So I'd like to say it's virtue, but it's also necessity. So organizations like EDCs and business partnerships and the Chamber of Commerce in the history of San Diego have played an extraordinary role in bringing people into the kind of tent you're talking about and saying, where does our economic future lie? And mobilizing and flying to Washington, which wasn't so easy. You took trains back in the 20s and 30s. But bringing the military here, bringing a university here, focusing on today, renewing the urban core. So that is an asset. I think there's a second one, and Rich and I have partnered on this. Our proximity to Mexico has a lot to do with that. So that if Malin Burnham lived in St. Louis, would he say, tear down that wall? If Malin Burnham lived in St. Louis, would he say, why don't we just legalize drugs so that we don't have all this crime related to the drug traffic? Would be unheard of. And he was Mitt Romney's chief fundraiser. So the nature of our location, proximate to Mexico, creates a sense of place and an awareness of interdependencies that cross these jurisdictional and international boundaries that gives us a different kind of culture. The third thing that I think is critical about San Diego, and I, like Rich, write books. I sell 3,000 and he sells 3 million. But I am writing another book about San Diego and actually comparing it with a couple of European cities. I think there are two things about San Diego we have to appreciate. And one is our engineering culture. And Steve, this is in your wheelhouse because our long history of building our economy first on the military bases, then on defense contracting, which gave rise to a talent pool, which in peaceful times ended up fueling the growth of all these innovation sectors, has been to our benefit. So that's the positive side. The reason Chris and I felt so strongly we wanted to have this event here is the negative side. And I, for me, Rich, I began to see it in the Clinton years, right? Rah, rah, internet. Now everything's mobile telephony. Everything's high tech. And 20% of the population, effectively, was benefiting from that. And most of us in this room represent that population. But all of those innovations were reducing the need for certain kinds of services, changing the nature of retail, taxi cab drivers and Uber drivers. The whole thing is churning. And inadvertently, it's left many communities behind. And so I think this focus on inclusive innovation is, if we know how to collaborate, we've built big tents in the past, and we know how to leverage our assets, let's mobilize all that energy to create a bigger tent that includes Barrio Logan, the Diamond, all the contiguous neighborhoods, because San Diego and California are no longer a majority state. One-third Anglo-American, one-third Asian American, and one-third Latino. If we aren't in a tent together, the state, our city, won't make it.
Well, what you did so successfully here, particularly when I think about the enormous asset of UCSD, and there are many others, but you think about that asset many years ago, many decades ago, of building one of the world's greatest engineering, biotech, scientific centers of innovation, and how few other places. You know, we live on the East Coast. We spend our winters in Florida. This is something Joel Kotkin, my former nemesis and now good friend, agree on. California, one of the things it did, you not only have warmth and beaches and sunshine, you have among the greatest universities in the world. But Mary said something very prescient about a dual economy. I call it a 30th, not a 1% or a 10%. There's a third of us who are in the knowledge, professional, creative work that are doing okay. We may be suffering from more expensive housing because we all want to live in the same 10 or 12 metros, but we, even when we take the course of housing into account, we're doing okay. There are 66% of us who were formerly industrial workers like my dad who work in these service jobs, prepare our food, take care of our kids, wait on us in hotels today. We're falling further and further behind. I just read Peter Temin, the great economic historian. I strongly recommend this paper. I'm going to be writing about it. He called it America's dual economy. He traces it back to the 70s and 80s, just as you said, Mary, that we not only lost manufacturing. Globalization sundered these connections, which enabled to build local economies, like which had an agricultural hinterland, which had manufacturing. We became global, and all that stuff came through supply chains. So what we ended up with, he calls it a 70-30. I call it a 66-33, but the numbers are pretty close. A 30% in finance, technology, electronics, high-tech, entertainment, and media doing okay, and 70% falling behind. You saw the result. The result just came in on election night. So we've got to heal that. We've got to heal that locally. Now, Mary mentioned the mega region, which you know we've worked on together. What an asset. And, you know, I actually believe, and we're going to work on this more with our friends at Brookings and elsewhere, that this is really could be a North American moment, even despite Mr. Trump. But the idea that Mexico provides so much skill and talent and manufacturing capability, a lever of foreign investment, and the United States with all its, and Canada, you know, don't forget where I live part of the year. This is an enormous mixture that we have. And, you know, your mega region, if you define it locally, you know, it's 6.5 or so million people. It's $200 billion in economic activity. If you just loop in that, what's that little city to the north of here? Los Angeles. Los Angeles. Man, if you loop them in and
so
you think,
well
of, if you think about the mega region that you are part of, you're part of one of the 10 or 20 biggest countries on Earth. You're bigger than Sweden or Switzerland or Hong Kong. This is an economic powerhouse. And the one last thing I want to say, though, and I think which is cause for optimism around this inclusive economic development theme, I think we'll dig into. I wrote about this in 2005 when I moved to Washington, and I saw the partisan divide there, and I couldn't believe it. You know, it was my inoculation. And I said, I hear all these people yelling and screaming, Democrat, Republican, and if I go to San Diego, or if I go to Orange County, or if I go to Wichita, or if I go to Buffalo, if I go to Rochester, if I go to that City Lab conference, I can't tell you which mayor is Republican, which mayor is independent, and which mayor is Democrat. I couldn't figure it out by talking to them. So that tells me, right, there's something happening at the local level where we are all in it together, where we get by the partisan divide. And I think for those reasons, that really a call to action to really begin to address our divides, to address our divisions, and develop real nonpartisan solutions that work happen increasingly right here at the local local level.
Let me ask you guys. Let me take it into a sort of a darker darker track. You know, I'm sort of MSNBC's token dark soul. I used to work for Richard Nixon. There are not many in MSNBC that work for Richard Nixon. I'm interested in competition. You know, you do a lot of lists, and when you publish lists, you're essentially basically identifying who's best, who's worst, who's doing whatnot. And recently, I've done a lot of focus on the innovation in cities. We just had City Lab in Miami with Richard. I was in Charleston, South Carolina, it's a growing place, but it has lots of stresses and challenges within how to, you know, continue to attract the right kinds of jobs, the right kind of people. What are the sort of infrastructure bets that it makes? How to kind of create a hip, cool corridor when you have a population, an incumbent population that doesn't particularly like a lot of the new hip crowd coming in. So I'm interested in the more ruthless part of how San Diego moves forward. And looking, if this is a Darwinian competition between cities to attract talent, to get the equation right, to bridge parts of the community there, what are three or four of the most important self-interested things that are less kumbaya, but just, you know, going to kick Charleston's ass? excuse me for right. being vulgar here, but I mean, I mean it in a sense of how do you organize in such a way that you see... It's not that Charleston has to go down, but how do you basically say, we don't want to just talk in kind of platitudes about doing things right, but you're going to put forward, you know, a five-point agenda, and this is what we've got to get right to get the community moving forward. Mary?
Well, echoing Rich's experience, we don't look hip. You know, we're not cool. And so students from UCSD are going to Santa Monica or going to San Francisco. But there's as much stuff happening downtown. We have the data in San Diego as in those cities. So there's a real issue about the divide between the Torrey Pines Mesa, where the tech companies are and the university is, and downtown. And part of the reason Chris and I have become partners in crime is the trolley. I am convinced that this city and UCSD are going to be transformed by the fact that you can take a trolley from the heart of the UCSD campus to the heart of downtown to the Mexican border. And that's going to allow a flow of talent and people that's really important. I think there's a second issue, Steve, which is affordability.
Right.
Yeah.
It's a huge issue, and I want to defer to Rich on this, but even young assistant professors and young engineers at Qualcomm don't want to live in suburbs anymore.
No doubt.
They don't want to go to malls for the weekend. They like urban, walkable, accessible environments. Yep. We have yet to create that. Little Italy has become that kind of place. And I know a lot of folks are working on the East Village and other parts, but we have to create that. But if it's only affordable to 65-year-old retirees,
no doubt,
you're not going to get edgy, talented millennials living downtown. And I'm going to say a third thing about inclusiveness, and again, I defer to Rich, because I'm at UCSD. You know, the young don't have issues around, are you a Muslim? Are you a Jew? Are you a Catholic? Do you come from Syria? Do you come from Guatemala? If you're smart and fun, who cares? I'll marry you. And
you're absolutely right.
This idea of inclusive economic development and an inclusive social movement is so deeply cultural. And if young people don't see our community as having that tapestry, it's not as attractive. But, Rich, you're the expert.
So wait, before, Jim, I want to ask you one other thing.
Right.
You know, this is not a commercial for Bank of America, but Bank of America has done so many great programs that I've seen around the country, not only looking at, you know, education and youth and community empowerment, for those people rising, although they do a tremendous amount. It's also looking at how you get connectivity and community with people that are already living there. And
that's
you're doing
right.
that, you know, and I'm just sort of interested when I think about Richard Florida and what he's really put on the table about creatives. Creatives aren't only young folk.
Right.
Creatives can be a lot of other folks. And as people live longer, as they find other points.
Yes.
And
I'd
so
like to
I'm interested
I'm
in how to unlock that piece of it. And B of A has done a lot and probably has a lot of great data on that from around the country. But to what degree does that need to be part of the awakening of a community? Because I think there's a lot of biases against those who are talented but who may not be the 21-year-old cafe goer who was comfortable working in a 1099 economy.
The growing awareness, many people have said the biggest problem in San Diego compared to the Silicon Valley is what I'm now writing about. We're an engineering culture. We're not a design culture. And I see Mark Steele and I see Rob. And I think there's a movement afoot at UCSD and in the community to talk about issues related to design and building and including, if you will, a broader community of people as creatives. There's something I'm dying to say that is sort of related, and that is that people who run large companies on the Mesa, which are organized, they're not vertically integrated companies anymore, right?
Yep.
Qualcomm contracts out for its landscaping services. It contracts out for catering services.
Right.
It contracts out for all kinds of talent. Those people need to be made aware that south of 8, they're people who could bid and become a part of their supply chain. So part of the issue is to take people who are creative and innovative in the tech sector and help them see how they can also be socially innovative just by changing some of their policies. So in that sense, it's not just about young and edgy. It is about old you-know-whats, thinking differently.
I like older and edgy.
Old and edgy. Thinking about where do I contract for my services? Who am I going to work with? And having a broader view. But Rich is the expert.
Rich?
So let me jump in here. The word I call for your what you call the dark issue that I coined and I talk about, it's the second chapter of the new book, is winner-take-all urbanism. We all know what a winner-take-all economy looks like.
Right.
But we now have a winner-take-all urbanism. The very good news is that San Diego is a big winner. The big winners are either large superstar cities like New York or London, and I would put Los Angeles in that category.
So can I stop you there for a minute? Is San Diego a big winner and conscious of how it got there, or did it stumble into that status?
Well, I think Mary and her colleagues have made us conscious. I don't know if anyone did this consciously and strategically, but it made a set of very smart decisions,
right,
at however covert or overt.
It was value-driven, yeah, if mm-hmm. not strategy-driven. Does that mm-hmm. make
and
sense?
And so I think San Diego is a big winner. And the second category I call the tech and knowledge hubs. The San Francisco Bay Area would be the most obvious example, but Washington, D.C., Boston, San Diego, and a few others, you know, and smaller ones. Boulder, Colorado would fit this. Even in the shadow of Detroit, Ann Arbor, Michigan would fit this as a smaller community. I would say you have to get ready for more winner-take-all urbanism. One of the things which I think will happen to you is, in contrast to some of my friends who want to see a migration of the creative class into the heartland, I think this election is a signal that that will never happen, that we are going to see the opposite migration. No matter how high your housing price is, whether it's San Diego or San Francisco or Boston or Washington, people are going to flock to these communities who have a more open-minded, tolerant, diverse set of values, who want to raise, not only meet and mingle with singles, who want to raise their family in a community that reflects those values. So I think you're going to have more people heading here. Certainly, where I live in Toronto, we're selling off beds in our third floor. But I think this is coming, so prepare for a migration of even more people, despite how housing prices are, more relatively affluent people. Look, when we talk about inclusiveness, it's not just urban and suburban. It's not just the creative class and the service class. It's all age groups. The creative class was never a demographic category about the young. It's a category that includes all age groups. It's by profession and the kind of work we do. But the interesting thing that a group of researchers just turned up is actually there's more creative class people in suburbs than there are in cities. Now, the creative class tends to go to the most close-in suburbs and the more walkable suburbs and the ones that are connected by transit or the ones around universities. Mm-hmm. But that is meant to say that the creative class is not just an urban vibe. There is a large group of people in the suburbs. So you said, what do I think you need to do? First, I think Mary made an incredibly prescient point about design versus engineering culture. Mm. I live in Toronto. Toronto isn't far from Waterloo. Does anyone know what Waterloo is? Waterloo I got to know when I taught at Carnegie Mellon, when I said, what do people think are great universities? Well, we sent one of our great people, Pradeep Koshli, here to run your university. But they would say UCSD and Waterloo. And I'd say, where the hell is Waterloo? Is that where Napoleon or somebody was? I don't know. Though that's that university in Canada. You know, that's the place that created RIM, which for a long time was seen as the future. And my students said, RIM will die. Because Waterloo is remote and it has an engineering culture and they need to move some stuff to downtown Toronto or a place like San Francisco or New York because they have to get designers. So Mary's caution about this, it's not an either or. You have a great strength in engineering. And what the design culture seems to require is a little bit more of that urbanity. You know, when I interviewed Fred Wilson, the great venture capitalist, about what he did in New York, he said, well, now it's no longer just engineers making startups. It's these artsy people who think like musicians or artists. They want to live in more urban areas. So, and we do know that, you know, even in San Diego, when we look at walkability and urbanity, we did a report on this. The preponderance of new startups, not established companies, are being formed in walkable, urban, dense zip codes. Mm. The two largest zip codes for venture capital startups in the world are both in downtown San Francisco around SoMa. They both attract more than $1 billion a year in venture capital, more than the entirety of San Diego, more than any other nation in the world. So that's one. Second thing, and we're going to have to do this at the local level, we have to make this clustering of people work for us, not against us. We have to make it work for us, not against us. So I think there's three or four things we need to do. You mentioned streetcars and trolleys. We need a massive investment in infrastructure. Now, Trump may do some of that. I'm not sure he's going to do the right stuff. We're going to have to, and one of the great positives of election night was so many communities around the country and states voted for transit spending. We're going to have to focus on infrastructure to connect our communities, right? That's one. Number two, we're going to have to invest massively in affordable housing. And some of you here call it workforce housing. We have to create housing that's affordable for the people whom our economy depends, not just the high-end people. Mm-hmm. So a massive commitment to affordable housing. We have to upgrade service work. This is something, you know, creative work, professional work, knowledge work, design work has upgraded itself. We made, I always want to make this point. I want you guys, if there's one thing you take away, manufacturing jobs, God didn't deem good jobs. My father got one in 1934. He told me it was a job. Excuse my French. It took nine people.
They're going to have a lot of bleeps in this.
Nine people to support his family. My dad, his six siblings, my grandmother and grandfather. He came back from the war, and all of a sudden, the very same job in the same factory in the Ironbound section of Newark was a good job. Why? We had the New Deal. We had gave unions the right to collectively bargain. We did many things that it took as a society. Henry Ford said this. How are we going to sell those cars if we can't give the workers the money to buy them? We elevated manufacturing jobs as a society. We have to do the same thing with service work. And, you know, in a way, who's more important to you? The person who builds your car, you're willing to pay more for a car made somewhere else. You're willing to pay more for an air conditioner or refrigerator. We can all pay a little bit more for our food. We can all pay a little bit more for the people who take care of our kids. We can all pay a little bit more for the people who take care of our ailing parents. It's not a lot of money. So these 70 million jobs that people are living in poverty, scared out of their wits, we've got to elevate those jobs. And the other thing, I think we've got to get over this city-suburban divide. What people want is to live in a great community. And one of the things that I've learned is our best cities are starting to look like our best suburbs. Look at New York City. I didn't want to live there in 1975. I was scared to death to go visit New York City. New York City, crime is down. Schools are better. You have access to the waterfront. It is still an urban center, but it's not the urban center of my youth. Look at our suburbs. They're adding walkability. They're building transit hubs. They're building, you know, the difference, and I want to say this, the difference between walking around parts of Soho and parts of La Jolla, which look like they were two completely different planets when I was a boy, they have much more similar now than I could have ever imagined. The point is that we have to get over this thing about city and suburb. We all want to live in great communities. Some of us want to live in a home. Some of us want to live in an apartment. Some of us want a little more density. Some of us want a little less density. But the poles of this debate are shrinking, and I think that's really the San Diego opportunity to build a great urban core and to also continue to renovate and remake your suburbs so that they're great places to live as well.
You know, it's really a great frame, Richard. Recently, I interviewed the mayor of Oklahoma City. The mayor there a few years ago was being touted as being one of the most dynamic and innovative mayors in the country. You had lots of investment coming into the city, lots of new enterprise, but it was also one of the most obese cities in the country. And he went on a campaign not only for himself to lose weight, but the entire community. And he got Oklahoma City to lose 1 million pounds, got 47,000 people to sign up. Now, why it's important, my family happens to be a couple hours north from Bartlesville, Oklahoma, is that building community or thinking about it, and I think, you know, one of the comments that was made is we're over here in this part of town that it's important. Building community and getting people to understand that they're on the same boat, that they're in this. To get 47,000 people to commit in Oklahoma City to lose, you know, to get healthier. And then what did this lead to? It's led to a campaign, exactly like you said, of spending legislation that got voted on the city to redesign the city to create greater walkability. So that is the Oklahoma City story in a very red state. And it raises the interesting question, because we're talking, because of the political period in these divides, of whether or not you see, Richard, opportunities in outside the urban core. Steve Case, the founder of AOL, and I went on a bus tour through the Midwest of the United States with a number of people, what we called a startup, it was called Rise of the Rest. Steve was out there actually pretending to be philanthropic in this, but he had a lot of self-interest, looking for great ideas in the Midwest of the country that New York and Silicon Valley hadn't found. And we would have, you know, pitches, and then Steve would put $100,000 and give him the best one and, you know, end up being the investor. It's kind of buying a good idea at wholesale rather than retail. But what you found when you went to Dubuque, Iowa, and Madison, Wisconsin, and you were in St. Louis, you were in various places, and some were, you know, city frameworks, but a lot of the best talent came from places around. And I'm interested in the story of non-urban creatives. Is there one there, Richard?
Yeah, so two things. One, I'm actually extremely optimistic. And part of the reason I'm optimistic is because in a city like San Diego or New York or Los Angeles or San Francisco, you can't sweep these problems under the rug. If you're going to develop a tech center and innovation center, you're going to deal fundamentally with problems of inequality and segregation and inclusiveness and affordable housing. So in a way, when we were separated between city and suburb, you could say, oh, I'm off in my gated suburb. It's not going to bother me. The city can just decline. It's not going to care. And today, we have to make propulsive, clustered, agglomerated, innovative places. We've got to deal with these problems. So I'm optimistic. Second, yes, there is a – well, there's going to be more creativity in non-urban places for a simple reason. Young people can't afford to live in urban centers. You're very lucky in a way that you have a downtown that still has spaces, which Jane Jacobs would have called new ideas require old buildings. New ideas require old buildings. You still have areas of town which are ripe for renovation. They're still underpriced. So New York doesn't have any more of those. It's got to go to Jersey City or Newark. So you have areas and spaces that can be renovated. But the big area of creativity is going to have to come from the suburbs. That's where the cheaper spaces are now. That's where the big floor plate, dilapidated buildings are. So obviously, but you mentioned something about Mick Cornett, the great mayor of Oklahoma City, that I think is really part of this, which we haven't talked about. The red-blue divide is a divide not only of wealth and affluence and talent and education, it's a divide of health and fitness and well-being. Look around the room. We don't have £1 million to lose here. This is a very fit and healthy group of people. And one of the things that we know is that as people get more affluent, more educated, they have the means and the ability to prioritize their health. I spend a lot of my time trying to preserve whatever is left of me, right? I have a trainer. I work out. I can't believe I learned how to eat better as an older person. I mean, all of these things that I have, I'm blessed. So, but I think what one of the big crises in this country is the divide of obesity, of diabetes, of all of these related illnesses are a divide based on class and geography. So this is his genius, to bring together a community not just based on economic inclusion, but around being healthier. And the things that create health and well-being that we all want for our parents and our loved ones are the things that I think we can build real community around. So, Steve, I want to echo what you said. It's not just about economic inclusion. It's about giving people longer and healthier lives.
So what I'm deriving from the conversation between the two of you is it's the idea of a common cause.
Yep. And common cause and building out connections.
Yeah, right, and making connections because we all care about similar things. And what is extraordinary about this city, having been multiple war economies, is people have mobilized around war efforts in this town. Mm-hmm. And that's brought disparate people into the room. We need to find a 21st century issue or idea to mobilize around. But the second thing I wanted to say that I hadn't thought about enough, Richard, but you know, your point about the future being an integration of these different kinds of neighborhoods and places and spaces, that's realistic for two reasons to me. One, the web. Technology liberates us to do work in very, very different ways. And to solve our everyday problems, including our health problems, in very different ways. So place matters, but in a different way. But the second thing is transportation. And I think the transportation is not more time on freeways.
Absolutely.
I think it's in San Diego.
Somebody wanted to applaud that.
Yeah. But in San Diego and in California, I mean, I learned to drive when I was 14. My dad was outrageous. And I learned to shoot a gun when I was 15. Right. So you know the kind of dad I had. But, you know, driving is like our lifeblood. And I've just been working in Stockholm and, you know, jumping on buses and then on the subway and moving around. It's just built into the lifestyle. So for these reasons,
I'm trying to find someone to show me something Stockholm gets wrong.
I know.
It's so irritating.
Cold weather.
But let me, you know, you mentioned Stockholm, and one of the things, when I was down in San Diego a lot and running a nonprofit that had offices down here, and you know, that we haven't discussed, and I find to be such an extraordinary strength of San Diego, is there's a kind of not often discussed internationalism here that is really profound and important. I remember Kazuo Inamori of Kyocera. I remember the Samsung guys. You had, you know, large Japanese investment. You had the maquiladoras across. I don't know what the scene is like now. You had Qualcomm, of course, which is now global. Every one of us owes Qualcomm an enormous debt for being able to talk because the little gizmo that is in our cell phone and the connectivity we have all came out of here. But that international dynamic is one that I would add to the list of something, if yes. not to continue to reinforce, to actually to put a flag on and say, hey, we get this right.
Well, Rich talked about Joel Kotkin.
Right.
And Joel has written about this, okay. you know, Korean markets and all the kids go to UCLA and become medical doctors and engineers. That is the dynamic of California. I think it's less, that diversity exists here, Steve, but it's less visible to the downtown powers that be, which still tends to be dominated by multiple generation landowners and builders and graduates of regional universities. The minute you move up to the Torrey Pines Mesa, 52% of the freshman class at UC San Diego are not Anglo-European. The minute you walk into a Qualcomm staff meeting, you see, so the knowledge-based industries are extremely diverse, very large, vibrant Indian-American communities, Chaldean communities.
Yep.
And I feel that as, and maybe I'm sounding judgmental there about this, but as I spend more time downtown, I don't feel that the values Kevin Faulkner's trying to articulate with his idea of one San Diego are as manifest yep. as they are in some of our newer suburbs. So paradoxical.
Huh. So two things about this. One, Mary knows this. I really believe there was one great genius to America, to the East Coast, the California experiment. And that isn't that we're big and we're on coast. It's that we allowed immigrants in. And that's really the difference. What created the vibrancy, what makes America ingenious, is what makes us innovative. What created California was immigrants from all over the world. You know, and that simple fact that between a third and 50% of all of our high-tech startups have a foreign-born founder just says it all. The other point that's related to that, some people hear that. I've heard it in some cities. We want high-skill immigrants. We want biotech engineers. We want software engineers. It doesn't work that way. I lived in Pittsburgh, which has had one of the slowest levels of foreign-born population, lowest levels of immigration. And when we asked immigrants, very high-skilled people, what it takes to lure them to their community, they, to a person, said, we want a place that's open to all. We want a place that has not just we're here because we're a doctor or a lawyer or a software engineer, that's open to everybody. We heard that time and time again. So I think this idea of immigration at every level and embracing it. The second point was about transport and infrastructure. And I think there's two points that I want to try to drive home. The one is there's no doubt we need better transit infrastructure, rail infrastructure, even in this state, high-speed rail, connecting its nodes of activity. And we need to be able to move people from an outlying area to a core area quicker. But the other part is, I think, what Mary mentioned, more people can work where they live. You know, Los Angeles may be one of the best examples of it. There are people who live and work now bustling downtown. There are people who live and work on the West Side. There are people who live and work in Santa Monica or Venice. There are either people who live further. I could go on and on. I think this idea of creating more self-contained, we're going to need to get between places, but the idea of a neighborhood or neighborhood-based development, and that's where I think the opportunities for urban revitalization and suburban revitalization, the idea of mixed-use live-work, the idea that you'll not only have offices, but co-working spaces like the Neuhaus in New York City, where people come and they have offices and they work together. This idea, I call them not only third places like the coffee shop or the Cheers bar, a fourth place, which is built for co-working. All of these things about keeping us in our communities and, of course, giving us the transit option. You know, one of the things we mentioned, Joel, a couple of times that he and I have in common is we both try to bicycle to work. Now, I live in the urban core. He lives in a suburb of Orange County. But in a way, and we live in different places. Mine's taller. His more spread out. But we both want to ride a bicycle to work. So the point is, if we can somehow create a little bit more what we need where we are and better transit connections, that could take a lot of the pressure off our auto-centric transportation system we have today.
This is extraordinary. I've lost track of days. I just came in from Abu Dhabi, so I think it's Thursday morning, right? And it's early in the morning. It's an extraordinary crowd here, you know, trying to think about the future of this community and how to get it right. And as someone on the editorial side of a major U.S. publication, it's been around since 1857, so we have to disrupt ourselves. We're entering in a new phase of apps, of technology, of sensors being wrapped in self-driving cars, the way in which everything will be measured. Sometimes I worry that when we think about the kind of world we want, we're planning for the world of yesterday, not the world of tomorrow. When you begin to think about what we begin hearing about the technological opportunities, but just really retrofitting everything in it coming, you know, what do you think would be the disruption that this community, this room here, should most embrace and be ready for in terms of transforming itself into one of the great creative magnets that Richard talks about? So let's make it kind of brief. But you know, what would be the things you'd put on
the
table?
I'm going to do off the top of my head. I might say something different tomorrow. I think it's what Rich and I were alluding to. More and more people are going to be their own employer. Hmm. And we keep thinking, preparing people for the workforce. What is the person who hires you looking for? Hmm. And I think the issue is, what do you need to do to be your own business? Hmm. And there's a lot to suggest that jobs, and I mean from the labor unions to the libertarian analysts, everyone is agreeing there's going to be less work in the employment sense. But if people have living wage and income, I can build a business around apple butter. Apple butter.
That's the Mary Walsh shop.
That's the Mary Walsh shop.
Apple
That's
butter.
That's Nashville, Indiana, the capital of apple butter, which you could only get if you went to Nashville.
Have you ever said this in public before?
Yeah. Well,
this
no, not in public.
Yeah,
only after
really,
three margaritas.
This is a powerful moment.
But now you can get apple butter online.
Yeah.
And Rich, I mean, I think that we're not thinking that way. We're still thinking about jobs. We should be thinking about work. There's a difference. And if we don't start thinking about work, what we do it, how we do it, where we do it, and that's different than the 20th century notion of a job, we're going to miss the boat.
So I want to say two things.
Yes.
You know, Jane Jacobs, when I asked her what her most important contribution was, said, most of you economists think it's important to create jobs. Companies create jobs. But the real key is to create new work. And new work comes from cities. Because it comes from innovative people coming together in cities creating their own kinds of new work. So Mary's 100% right. Two things. One, and echoing the themes we've been talking about. One, I think we are ripe for a real radical devolution. The best companies in the world taught us it's not vertical integration and top-down management that works. The companies that located here, that were built here, that had those maquiladoras, all showed us during the 80s and 90s that what works is empowering groups of workers on the factory floor, working with great suppliers, and building a team and decentralizing decision-making. The same thing goes for building a great country, a great state, devolving power to the community and to the neighborhood and letting them run. That's number one. The second thing I find is an interesting application for San Diego. You mentioned technologies. I've been working with a technology company, a very big technology company that will remain nameless. It shouldn't go farther, much farther than this room, but it's on video. Mm. That company is thinking about the new way to develop community. And in its deliberations, they're thinking about not only building a job site and a work site, but building what would be a mini city. With all of the advances in transport, self-driving cars, autonomous vehicles, the kinds of mobile transit, the kinds of sensors, all of this stuff in buildings. And what's so interesting about it is they can't decide where to put it. Not only they can't decide where to put it geographically, they can't decide whether it should be an urban brownfield. In other words, should it be in an area like we are today, in an inner city where they could amass the property? Or should it be in a suburban area close to a university or an airport? That tells me something. That the opportunity for this new way of thinking about the intersection of technology, new work, innovation, isn't one or the other. Mm. It should be both.
I want to thank you. You know, another line of from Jane Jacobs that I love is that dealing with cities is dealing with life at its most complex and intense. And when I hear that, I hear opportunity. I hear you have an opportunity to shake things up. And as I said when I opened this, and I wasn't being gratuitous, I love San Diego, and I love the fact that so many people take these issues seriously and wonder what needles need to be pushed. I have great respect for this mayor, who is bridging divides here that I haven't seen before. I've sort of drilled down into that particular thing, and I'm not trying to be nice to him either. I'm not nice to most people. But it's one of these interesting things that as you look forward, and Richard and I have the privilege of going to a great number of cities around the country. He goes and around the world. I think San Diego, it's time to hit that tipping point, you know, be out and proud and you matter, and host City Lab here, and you know, be, you know, take that to the, you know, the next level. And so this is the guy to kind of get on that track. So I want to thank very much Richard Florida, Mary Walshock. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.